Welcome to episode 31 of Redesigning Cities, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech. I'm your host, Ellen Dunham-Jones, director of the Master of Science degree in Urban Design here at Tech. And my guest today is Dilip Dacuna, an architect and planner based in Philadelphia and Bangalore and adjunct professor at Columbia University. He is author, with his late partner Anuradha Mathur, of several books challenging how we define the relationship between water and land and what that means for how we misunderstand floods, droughts, and climate change. I encourage listeners to visit the website that Mathur and Dacuna developed in 2017 called Ocean of Wetness. It's directed to imaging and imagining habitation in ubiquitous wetness rather than on a land-water surface. You may also want to check out his latest book, The Invention of Rivers, Alexander's Eye and Ganga's Descent. It received the 2020 ASLA Honor Award and the J.B. Jackson Book Prize. He also received a Guggenheim Fellowship to work on an upcoming book and exhibition called Ocean of Rain. To see his collection of maps and his uniquely provocative and beautiful drawings that accompany this work, listeners can watch the video of the Douglas C. Allen lecture that he gave last night in the School of Architecture lecture series. The link is on the Redesigning Cities website. Welcome, Dilip.
Thank you, Ellen. Lovely to be here.
So the title of your talk last night was the deceptively simple question, where does design begin? Let's begin there. Tell our listeners why you chose that title.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely start. I think it's a personal quest, that Anu and I share. And the question would keep coming up every once in a while, in the 30 years that we were married. When we started with the Mississippi project, it was more about how infrastructure can be included within design and how representation can be included within the design process. But there's so much in the map that we take for granted. Why do we not begin with a critique of the map before we actually accept our site, for example? Or why do we accept the engineer's marginalizing of mangroves and other wetlands and only begin when a dry site is given to us as an architect or a landscape architect? So we began to include things within the design process. So the Mississippi project led to the inclusion of infrastructure and of maps, of geographic map and how they represent things within design. And so we urged, post-Katrina, for example, we urged architects and landscape architects not to take the line between land and water for granted, but to look at it more critically, and to design as if there were no levees. It has sort of progressed, and now we're in the stage of sort of questioning the acceptance of the Earth's surface as a ground, because the surface is in trouble. It's affected by rising seas, storm events, glacier melts, species extinction and everything. So there's something to question over there. Why do we take the surface for granted? And if you think about it, there's so much of stuff, including dust that rises beyond it, wetness that rises beyond it, air that is above it. Why do we deny all that when we actually include a surface that, or let's just say, includes an earth with a surface that marginalizes all the other elements that are so necessary to life? So that's the reason for the question for this particular lecture was really questioning this.
Well, yeah, and I think that so much of your work looks at the boundaries and this idea that somehow, yes, there is this line between dry land and wet land, and that as designers, what do? We make lines. We are making boundaries. I love, your phrase that there is no such thing as dry land. Wetness is everywhere to some degree. It is in the seas, the clouds, rains, dew, air, soils, minerals, plants, animals. The sea is more wet than the desert, but these lines are blurred. To say the least.
Absolutely.
Even though you're opposed to the binary of land water, you constructed a very sort of binary presentation of what you described as the drain imagination versus the rain imagination. Explain that.
The drain imagination really accepts the presence of a surface, or let's just say it takes the presence of a surface for granted. So we look at rain as falling to a surface and draining to the sea, evaporating from there and returning in the form of rain. And so that's the hydrologic cycle that we teach all our children. So that reading of falling to a surface puts us as human beings above the surface, looking down upon it. in a way. And so it keeps us outside, or takes us outside of a wetness that actually consumes us. Whereas a rain imagination accepts that immersion. So you look at rain not falling to a surface, you look at rain as wetting a world that is already wet, just making it more wet, you know. And so the way in which that wetness moves is unique. I mean, it doesn't fall to a surface. It seeps and soaks its way down through the air. And that understanding is so different. This acceptance of an immersion in wetness just changes the way in which one looks at the world. And when, you know, one cannot look at water then anymore as separate from land. You don't have that urge if you accept that. So once you accept immersion, then you're always working on relative ground, more wet, less wet. There's no such thing as dryness in there. So, because I mean, you yourself are wet. I mean, your eye is wet. When I'm presented with a, you know, with an earth now that is modeled, you know, not to have any water, it is a denial of one's own eye. I mean, so we've reached a level of absurdity, actually, where we're creating images that deny ourselves, our own presence. So this is where, I mean, I feel that the dream imagination and rain imagination really diverge.
They do.
Significantly.
I think, you know, you then kind of went on to further describe the drain imagination as absolutely that attitude towards the land is this surface upon which now I'm drawing lines as an act of colonization, as opposed to sort of the colonized of, you know, water is becoming managed and thought of as problem kind of thing. So talk a little bit more about how the colonizer imagination is trained. I mean, we're both teaching urban design and landscape and planning students. Are we teaching them to be colonizers?
The short answer is yes, but if I had to sort of step back and I look at the discussions that happened within the post-colonial world and the colonial world, you begin to see that they take land for granted. Much of the discussion that happens among social scientists, historians, others, they take land for granted. And so colonization is defined roughly as the taking of another person's land or controlling it and exploiting the land and resources of another people. What I would like to say is colonization is not just about taking another person's land and resources. It's about creating the land, making them inhabitants of land, and then taking the land. So then you have them now learning how to manage this land and how to extract its resources and how to think. So what you're doing actually is a much more fundamental act of colonizing place. And so that is what we have all been educated to. I mean, I come from a part of the world that, I mean, we're told colonized by the British and given independence in 1947. So given independence in 1947 is, you know, acknowledges self-rule of a land. And what is interesting is that it's not really independence, because we're continuing the language of land, which we have been taught. So look at it this way. The act of colonization is extracting people out of wetness, placing them on a surface, educating them into the surface, and giving them independence. So now they take care of the land that you have created. And that is why, I mean, you look at the world today, I mean, most of the former colonizers are still in charge. And the folks who were colonized are still developing. So this one realizes that what has happened is that the granting of independence has happened in a way after people have become forever dependent.
So often it's pitched as progress. It's certainly the capitalist system, but it's pitched as ways of improving the quality of life, presumably, not always equitably by any stretch. But given discussions of sustainability, do you see those as at all a move back towards recovering a sense of land and water that is less capitalist driven and less managed, or is it actually almost more, even more managed?
It's a difficult question, frankly, to answer, you know, but because there's a lot of work to be done in terms of clarifying the possibilities that we might have without land, to work with possibility of a relative situation of wetness and how we construct ground in the process with every project, or let's just say we are forever constructing using our ground to live on. If I choose to live in a cloud forest, I live in a particular way. I mean, not necessarily on a surface, but I constitute through design, you know, my mode of habitation in a cloud forest very differently from the way in which I would constitute it in the mangroves, for example, or in a, I mean, I don't want to use the word desert, you know, but in the Thar or the Sahara or whatever. So each place actually demands a particularity wherein there is an imagination that has a much more fundamental starting point of habitation. Where that takes us is, I would think, toward a place where it becomes kind of incomparable with a land-driven model or the colonized model of working that just assumes that land is everywhere, you know, all around the earth, and you just work with it. So I think what we have done today is made comparisons as if this land is shared by everybody. And so we are talking about the developing world and the developed world. We talk about the colonized world and the colonizing world, the East and the West, and all those kind of distinctions that have taken land for granted or that take land for granted. So much of the literature, I feel that as a starting point, does not actually deal with the real difference. So I guess what I'm saying is that there's a much more fundamental rupture that has not been explored. Land and wetness is that rupture. Or let's say the language of landscape on one side and the language of wetness. And we are yet to write the language of wetness. It's always been translated into the language of land. So how that plays out is a little uncertain, but that is exactly to some extent what the subject of Ocean of Rain that we're working on now is all about. You know, it's sort of leading the way in sort of opening the question of what might it be, actually, what might a true comparison be that accepts the rupture between land and wetness? What might it lead to, and how would one inhabit actually that rupture that is now in everybody? We're all part colonized and part colonized.
I completely agree. I think it's your timing. You've been thinking about these issues now for several decades, and yet you got a lot of laughs last night when you said, you know, water is having a Me Too moment. Because of climate change, there's, I think, that much more of an opening of people to begin to raise some of these questions and I think appreciate the kinds of questions that you're having us think about. I thought in the lecture was especially interesting was how you described various ways, just like you were talking about sort of the cloud forest or in the desert or, the, you know, the various ways of how we learn from the old ways of dealing with wetness, pre-colonial kind of old days, that is absolutely, it wasn't just accepting that, yes, the Nile and the Ganges and the Mississippi will rise on an annual basis. You expect it. It's not a crisis. It's normal. But you design for that and you celebrate in many respects what is happening there. I mean, talk a little bit more about how you see this, how we've turned water into a problem and a crisis because of climate change and how different that really is.
Yeah, I mean, it's really part of a long history. You know, I mean, if you look at the way in which land has been constituted, it has been constituted precisely because we've been able to put water in its place. And interestingly, we put water in its place in space, on a surface, and in time, in events. And so, you know, we think then that we are now in command of these events and this space of water. But the way I look at it is that it's a very plan-driven perception and reading of place. And plan is actually what dictates all our design initiatives, starting with sight. We are there, not here. It's given to us by the map, it's given to us by the administration, and that's how we operate. So it's very deeply deep set. This other side, wherein, you know, what you're talking about, I mean, of course, it's purely speculative on our part, that the ancients, and I call them ancients for a reason, actually, because I just want to put them as far as possible and not sort of speak for them as much as speak speculatively for ourselves, possibility, or just raise it as a possibility, that theirs was a sectional imagination, that they inhabited a wetness that rose and fell, that increased in intensity and decreased in intensity. And how you worked with that, you never saw things in plan at all. When you don't see things in plan at all, you don't think of putting water in its place. So if you think sectionally immersed in wetness, you are a relative being. And so then you're working with the wetness that opens up some amazing possibilities. This is the way I look at it as a designer. And so when I say like that's where design begins, it is about about saying, okay, now here is where in dealing with it, we don't arrive at a site. What we arrive at is a starting point of design, maybe an engagement, a practice that then leads us further. So there are many things that sort of open up with that sort of shift from plan to section. I sort of hesitate a little bit to talk about anything as pre-colonial, only because I don't know whether anything can be said with such definitiveness, but it is an area that allows for speculation. If one denies, let's just say, the weapons of colonization, I mean, and I call the surface and line weapons of colonization, one takes that out of the equation, and then one is not necessarily pre-colonial. I think I would say one is decolonial.
Let's go more into design activism towards decolonization. So if the section is one of the, I don't know, it's calling it a tool is even still a sort of colonizer attitude, but describe your project in Norfolk and how the sectional thinking that you applied in that project and sort of what you call the fingers of high ground. Yeah. Is that a decolonization project? Would you include that?
Yes, I would certainly think it is a decolonization project in the sense that it is taking us beyond the land-water divide. Most people are looking at the east coast of the United States as a coastline that is threatened by the sea that is beyond it. So we are already in a defensive mode in thinking about it like that. When we talk about fingers of high ground, we are opening up the coast sectionally, beginning to appreciate that what we're looking at is a rise and fall of sea that we know as tide. On the other side, the rise and fall of rain that comes with a hurricane and with other phenomena. But so we're working between rain and tide, which is already in time and already in section. So
yeah, you can't draw a plan.
Exactly.
Really.
Exactly.
That adequately describes
exactly
rain and tide.
Very true. I mean, and so the only interaction that they have is time and section, rise and fall. And so when one puts oneself in that world, I think it is already a decolonial world and a decolonized world that is arguing against plan-driven defensive imagination, where you're then forced to think either fight the sea or retreat. This kind of enemy language. I know people now talk about frenemy. I mean, frenemy is not any better than enemy. I mean, you know what I'm saying? It doesn't change the ground of design, but changing the ground of design from plan to section. But also, you know, one of the things that I want to say, I mean, is that we have reached this very interesting point wherein looking to the future in climate change and looking to the past in terms of colonization, there's this common ground, actually, that, you know, of social injustice on the one hand and climate issues of how science is redefining things. And so the coming together, actually, of both these in a single issue that I find particularly interesting. And that is why we can speak of decolonization so comfortably within the climate change discussions and not just within a kind of political social science kind of discussion. So I think questioning the surface, questioning land, brings these two conversations together, you know, and we realize that if you really want social justice, well, we'll automatically if we keep to this topic, we also resolve the climate crisis, you know, at the same time. So I find that particularly exciting.
I think it's also really interesting to look at how the inequities just play out differently in around the world in very different ways of who's on the high ground and who's on the low ground. And it's not always the low ground are the poor parts of South America. It's more common that actually the poor, they're on the high ground. In both cases, regardless, the inequities are playing out. But I think, yeah, the attention to those, I mean, is obviously extremely important. And you mentioned, do we retreat or do we reinforce? And, you know, yes, the sort of common attitudes towards sea level rise. What about designing environments and buildings to take a bath?
That's an interesting way of putting it. You know, I often tell students that if you really want to design, say, in the face of a hurricane, wouldn't it be better to inhabit the hurricane? I mean, that might be a start. Think about what it would be to design in the hurricane rather than to design for the hurricane. And that itself sets you off on a different ground. So if you're calling that a bath that we are within, how might we think of it? But here we have to distinguish. We have to distinguish between the amphibious, which is still a land-water sort of embrace, and this immersion within an event, So we've constructed these events. I can't imagine people who lived within a hurricane at one time, say, without having stepped out of it, did not know the beginning and the end of it in a way, or knew it in other ways, knew the whole thing in other ways. But today, we have to make a conscious attempt to step into a hurricane and design within it. So you're not strengthening your buildings to fight it. You're doing things very differently. I mean, the way in which you draw it, the way in which you are consumed by it. And you know, this is something I have never done, but I would love to actually experiment with the possibility.
The example of Varanasi, where you showed when the river rises, absolutely depositing mud throughout all the built environment or along the riverbanks. And then that all gets hosed off for the tourists coming in the dry season. As an example of just designing, knowing for the place we'll take a bath, and that's an annual event, very different from the hurricane example, more of an annual event.
Yeah.
Or the example you described of along the Mississippi River, the Indian mounds, and the difference between sort of thinking of the modern solution of let's build a levee, build a wall and contain this river, versus the Native American mounds that certainly allow the water comes through, it fertilizes the land around, but you have pieces, islands of high ground. I found those lessons very inspiring. I think those could apply to hurricanes as well.
One of the things that I would like to point out, I mean, in the case of Varanasi, when the water rises 60 feet, 2,000 years ago, it never rose at all. And that is what is interesting. I mean, if it rose, it must have risen by a few inches, maybe a couple of feet. But that is because the vast holding system in the Himalayas was still intact. The jungles, the clouds, the soil, everything was holding across this vastness. All that holding has been destroyed. As a consequence, water has been concentrated in now what we call rivers. I mean, and that's precisely the invention of a river, actually, from this vast wetness, has been made into this narrow thing that now rises 60 feet. So what you have over here in Varanasi is a face that is given about every year with this rise and fall, but it is not necessarily welcome. It is seen as something that is unwanted. And so the hosing down of all the soil, sending it back, I mean, it's an energy-intensive, violent kind of throw of stuff. So it doesn't quite work. It's just something that is quietly done in denial and not acknowledged. But if, when you point to the Native American mounds or the mounds in the Indus or the mounds in the Nile and, everywhere in most situations. I mean, I saw them in Bogota, which is 8,000 feet thing. Just the subtle little gradients that were constructed with earth. There, the wetness is welcome. The bath is welcome in the lower, because you're living on a gradient. You're always living on a gradient, not in a land water situation. So that example, I think, is a very good one. And that taking a bath every year with the rise and fall, I think, is something that is accommodated and made part of the practices. You know, the fertility is welcome. You don't wash away the soil, put the soil back in like they do in Varanasi. They actually welcome this layering and, you know, and things. So it becomes part of a practice-oriented, practice language of living with wetness.
How do we redesign cities for ubiquitous wetness?
Yeah, I have, thoughts on the question itself. I mean, in this end, that I would love to sort of expand the question from cities to habitation, because I do think that the language of cities as such, I mean, if one looks at, let's just say, the gradient that we place cities on, the city is the quintessential settlement. The village is a lesser settlement, and then, you know, you have wilderness at the other extreme, or forests, etc., the clearing in the forest. And that distinction, or let's say that gradient of settlement, is often made with a large dose of a drain imagination, in the sense that the village is less drained than the city. The city has this fantastic drainage scheme, knows exactly where water is, has gutters, this, that, and the rest of it designed for it. And even historians, actually, you look at when they define civilization, they're talking about civilization as well-drained cities. So there is that urge that I have of actually moving beyond cities, because cities are intrinsically a drained imagination that has sort of put water in its place. So if one wants to look at the redesign of habitation, beginning with the redesign of cities, then the first step would be, as we did in Bombay, is start redefining place. So in the case of Bombay, we said, what if Bombay is not an island, but Bombay is an estuary? Immediately we start thinking of holding systems. We start thinking of soaking systems. we start thinking of, you know, all these ways by which we begin to hold rain rather than drain it. And so then we're in place for drought. So that would be the first step, would be redesigning cities to accommodate it. I know the term that many people use now is sponge and things like that. I hesitate to use that because sponge does not have a continuity that allows you to critique the city itself. So when we talk about Mumbai in an estuary, the first step is to redesign the city for wetness. But then it is also to dissolve the city in some way. That, I mean, do we have to live with this as a quintessential settlement where water has its place and given a little freedom? Or can we now start talking about habitation in wetness, start changing the imagination of living within it? And that, of course, requires education, requires change of administration, questions of property. Does property apply to land? Does property apply to practices? And there are systems by which we can sort of shift these around. But I would think that, yes, first step is sort of obvious and I think is already being made across the world. I mean, I would think like Philadelphia paying a lot more attention to holding its rain and things like that. But I see that as not going far enough. And I think that the only way to go further is to question the city itself as an entity and say, is there another way of defining habitation? Is another way of not defining, but is there another way of inhabiting outside of the urban-rural divide that is holding us hostage? I would think it's really holding us hostage to an imagination that is drain-driven. So how we step out of that is, I would think, something that we have given a lot of thought to, but we would like to articulate further.
I'm so tempted to say, but the urban-rural divide, you're missing, at least in the U.S., where the majority of the population lives, which is the suburbs. And all of these questions that absolutely, I think, apply even more so. That's a lot of my bias. I want to actually, though, pick up more on and kind of lead us into a discussion to sort of wrap up. How do we teach the next generation to help them come up with their own answers to these questions? So the kind of issues of both representation and pedagogy. Your drawings, you invented a new way that focuses on sections, but also on a sequence of sections. I think it's so interesting that you and Anuradha were doing this at Penn, and certainly the legacy of McCarg, who also invented a new kind of representational system, also very section focused. But then you've added sequence to that in quite an extraordinary way. Talk a little bit about your pedagogy as you're teaching urban design students and landscape architects. How are you asking them to document both what they're looking at, but also what they're imagining?
That's a good question. I mean, I must say, I mean, over here that I was inspired by Anu in this regard, particularly. I mean, it was inspired. I mean, in all conversation, actually, she was a real inspiration because she was an inhabitant of wet in herself. I mean, in the way she drew, in the way she operated.
What do you mean when you say that she was an inhabitant of wetness in the way she drew? Explain what that means.
Well, let's say we taught together the 501. She used to begin 501 and I got drawn in. Introductory course in landscape architecture to non-design entry students. And she would take them on a walk in the forest. Of course, I began to take these walks with her and we would have students draw every, say, 200 yards and draw for a minute. They didn't have time to draw objects. They drew milieu. They drew the atmosphere. And she would always tell them, squint your eyes. You do this thing. And that, to me, was an engagement of wetness, as opposed to a land water system wherein, you know, you have these objects that inhabit a land surface. In her sketching, I mean, her own sketching, I mean, like when we were in Rome 2 years ago, we were in the Pantheon doing drawings, and then we were in Bernini's Plaza in St. Peter's doing drawings, and Anu was doing these rubbings on which she did the drawing. You know, but the first was the rubbing, and that rubbing, the tree or ring of travertine stone, there was a way by which she displaced things and set the milieu of her drawings before she engaged with her own drawing. When I say that she was an inhabitant of wetness when she drew, I would think there are these fantastic examples of just watching her work. They're very different from mine. I mean, I would just sketch on a paper. I mean, I don't use the word dry normally, but I think when it comes to my sketches, I would say they were pretty dry. But yeah, so So she led in this respect. So her pedagogical drive was to immerse students in the world. So when we did exercises like, we'd have students triangulate. So we put them in a surveyor's shoes, draw the surface, draw sections, but having them not accept the surface, not take the surface for granted, not take line between land and water for granted. So they were constantly having to invent. So we would put them in a situation prior to the land-water divide. And that pedagogical, I would say, immersion, really, I thought was so powerful because it's not about giving them the readings before studio. It is actually about having them engage in some way. I think that sort of practice initiation rather than intellectual initiation, I think is really a powerful tool in design.
Absolutely. I mean, I think experiential learning, yeah. You embody it, you live it at least a little bit. I will say at least the way our curriculum in urban design is here, we flip the order, rightly, wrongly, but it's just... So we have a summer program where we send students basically to Europe to experience 4 different cities, 2 weeks each city. 2 weeks is enough. It's not just a tourist. You really are getting some chance for experiencing different great urban designed places and internalizing some sense of why they work here, but the same strategy doesn't work there, understanding culture, a lot of other things. We do go to the Netherlands, and there's a lot of discussion of wetness probably more than most. But earlier in the curriculum, I feel like most of what I'm teaching is dimensions. And now, of course, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm teaching them to be colonizers, because it's certainly, I do feel the students, they need that experience of good and bad places and to get their own sense of why. They also do need to be able to draw and make lines, but whether that's just parcel lines, whether it's the dimensions of streets and buildings and all of that. What advice do you give to students, and what advice might you have for my curriculum of urban design teaching?
I fully agree with you. And this is something that we never avoided. I mean, in teaching 501, the studio that I've just spoke about in landscape, to have them draw with a sense of clarity and saying is, I think, essential. But to have them know where the ability to draw with dimensions comes from and what they are doing in the act of moving from experience to abstraction.
And the significance, really, of those lines, that they really matter.
Exactly. I mean, but to understand that line is an act of design, to understand, the line between land and water, to actually do it. It's like, it's like the question I ask people, can anybody here draw a line between land and water? You've got to be God to do something like that. You just got to be arrogant and assertive to actually do it. But today I find there are a number of students who just take it for granted that this is the line between land and water. When I'm seeing seepage, I'm seeing a whole set of gradients. I'm seeing, what people would call an ecotone and this and that as there already. To have students know that when they draw the line, they are excluding that gradient is, I think, an important one. So I would sort of agree with your curriculum. If it had to open students up to why, let's say to the design language of what they take for granted in the line and the surface and in their precision, in their drive to precision. So, after that, there's always, I like to say it, there's always a humor in the line. You know what to take seriously, what not to take seriously. It gives them a sort of leeway to be comfortable then with playing with something like this and not saying dogmatic, which I find is sometimes made a lot of when places like the Netherlands and, other places. So, whereas if I had to grow up in Bangladesh and things like that, I've seen the joy of actually being able to play with the line. If you want to enforce the line at all, at least let it be a play.
I do think we help the next generation confront the challenges of change, period, any kind of change, by both teaching them the conventions and understanding why we have these legal systems and property ownership systems and monetary fiscal instruments. And if we understand why those exist and we at least understand them, then we are in a better position to change change them instead of only assuming that they're fixed.
Yeah, the only thing I would add, you know, Ellen, is not just about why they're there, but how they're
yes.
there. And that how, to me, is the design question. That these are things that have been created out of, let's just say, with ingenuity in many. I mean, and this is where we, having critiqued, I mean, and I maybe make a lot about colonization and all that, but I admire to some extent the way a language has been implemented and how, you know, and with what success. So, for example, even in Bogota, the hills are covered with eucalypt. And I've seen eucalyptus in Sardinia, and, you know, in thing. I mean, I've seen it here, I've seen it, I mean, it's all over the world. It came out of colonization, it's come from Australia, and it's been planted with intention elsewhere, and it has taken over. I point that out to students and say, what a remarkable design initiative. You just plant a eucalyptus tree, I mean, in the way in which it takes over, sets up new economies, does this and that, and the rest of it is fantastic. How did somebody think of that? Without doing too much, you allow the tree to do its own thing. But this is what has happened. And so I think there's a lot to learn in the how, and a lot to admire and learn from. Yeah.
There's so much more we could discuss here. You know, I'd love to pick your brain on water cities, aquifers, groundwater extraction and refill, all these different ecosystem services and green infrastructure. But I think we're going to have to leave that to another time. I just want to thank you for inviting and allowing and encouraging us to actually go deeper into asking the how and the why and the questions on all these things. So thank you very much, Dilip Dacuna. And I want to thank our listeners. You've been listening to episode 31, Redesigning Cities for Ubiquitous Wetness, the Speedwell Foundation Talks at Georgia Tech.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.